This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the significance and outcomes of U.S. President Donald Trump's trip to Asia. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. U.S. President Donald Trump embarked on a 12-day trip to Asia, including stops in Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. President Trump's National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, said the president's trip would focus on three main goals. First, strengthening international resolve to denuclearize North Korea. Second, to promote a free and open Indo-Pacific region. And third, to advance American prosperity through free and reciprocal trade and economic practices. So with us to analyze the president's trip and its ramifications are two distinguished regional analysts. Walter Lohman is director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative think tank based here in Washington. And Patrick Cronin, he's senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And that's a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Walter Lohman, let me begin with you. The overall goal of the trip, security-oriented, trying to curb North Korea's ambitions, also trade. As the trip is ending, do you think President Trump has made progress toward fulfilling the trip's stated goals, i.e. advancing U.S. security and economic interests?
Well, we'll see what happens in the days to come. He clearly took that case to Beijing and talked to President Xi Jinping about the need to get tougher on North Korea, to enforce Security Council resolutions, to try to isolate North Korea. We won't know exactly how successful that is in for some time, because often the Chinese seem to commit to that, and then later we find out they haven't done so much. Obviously, in Korea and Japan, he has willing allies, people who are ready to do whatever they can in partnership with the United States to curb North Korea's nuclear intentions.
Patrick Cronin, just on a first overview of the trip, how do you see President Trump's fulfillment of the main goal so far?
Well, I think he's stuck to the script, and he has pursued both the security and the trade policies. Plus, he's outlined now what is the post-pivot strategy of the United States, that is, beyond the Obama administration's rebalance to Asia. It turns out that U.S. policy is largely one of continuity. And I think it's the most spectacular outcome is that there's very little change. And that's not a bad thing. This is based on longstanding interests in the region. And here you have this fairly unorthodox president coming in who has said a lot of harsh things, especially about multilateral trade, and been willing to criticize allies for not doing enough. And yet we've come away with a lot of continuity.
Well, we'll talk about some of the differences, particularly his abdication of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but we'll take on that later in the program. Back to you, Walter Lohman. Let's take a look at the first leg in Japan. That was a little bit of a love fest. There was a lot of good chemistry between Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and President Trump. He told Prime Minister Abe that Japan could protect itself from a nuclear-armed North Korea by buying billions of dollars of American military equipment, so drawing an explicit link between trade and security. How do you see that, and what is your biggest takeaway from that trip?
Well, I don't think that's the most constructive way to approach an ally, that is, encourage them to buy more stuff so that they can better defend themselves. But the Japanese already do buy a lot of American equipment, and our militaries already enjoy a good deal of integration. So he's right that the equipment they have and the equipment that they will purchase from the United States will help defend them, as will the extensive cooperation that we have with them. I think the excessive praise of Xi Jinping is a mistake. It puts the U.S. in somewhat of an inferior position, I think. I think whereby flattery is a very effective instrument for the Chinese, they're actually not very susceptible to it themselves. I don't know what he thinks he's accomplishing with that flattery, but I don't think it's a very good idea.
We're going to get into South Korea and his trip to Beijing in a minute. But first, let me go to Patrick Cronin for your take, Patrick, on that Japan leg.
Well, Carol, I was just in Japan, and Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, is tremendously buoyed by the recent snap election, where he's really gained a new lease on life politically. And here he now hosts President Trump, A man he sought out right after the election, was the first leader to come in and see him in New York, and he's formed a very close bond between the Prime Minister of Japan and President Trump. And I think the summit went exceedingly well from Prime Minister Abe's perspective. He got everything he wanted. And although some of the rhetoric that you cited about buying arms is not very statesmanlike in the normal run of things, we have to separate, I think, the administration's goals of Trump and the president's negotiating tactic. His negotiating tactic when he goes in with a leader is to focus on one or two objectives and to try to see if he can get a little more progress on one or two deals. He's very transactional that way. But the overall administration's policy is strong commitment to our cornerstone ally, Japan. We're going to work together on pressuring North Korea. We're going to work on improving trade and investment between the U.S. and Japan. They didn't disagree about a free trade agreement, which was a big potential ask from Trump to Abe. They agreed to kind of put that rhetoric to the side. But in fact, since the United States has withdrawn from TPP, a big goal of Prime Minister Abe, there's a great need to fill that space in.
We'll have more on that, but let's turn now to South Korea, Walter Lohmann, and your take on that particular leg of the trip. How would you characterize relations between Mr. Trump and President Moon, especially regarding the North Korean threat? What changed as a result of this trip?
Well, I think the relationship is good with some underlying tension to it. I mean, in that Moon comes from a completely different area on the political spectrum. He's a liberal, a progressive in the South Korean parlance, and Trump is a Republican, you know, and all that entails in American politics. So that underlies the good relationship. Moon has a tendency, he wants to promote good dialogue with North Korea, and Trump is just the opposite. What's brought us together are the nuclear tests and the missile launches and everything else that has papered over, really, those differences for the time being. And we'll see when things lighten up whether they remain as close.
But Mr. Trump did tone down his rhetoric, did
yes.
he not?
Yes, he did.
With regard to North Korea. How do you see it, Patrick Cronin, that trip to Seoul and the relationship between President Moon and President Trump, and to what extent can they cooperate, see eye to eye, on thwarting North Korea's nuclear ambitions?
I think Walter was right to emphasize the fact that despite the different ideologies of Moon and Trump, it's surprising how tightly wound they are together on a North Korean strategy. Basically, President Moon of South Korea got from President Trump what he wanted. He got a commitment to say that our pressure strategy, which we agree on, maximum pressure on North Korea to try to come to the table, is oriented toward the objective of diplomacy, and that we don't want to see military action. That was a concession relative to the kind of harsh rhetoric that we've seen earlier.
Indeed. And before we leave Seoul, let me ask you, Walter Lohmann, about this new rapprochement between China and South Korea. As you know, Beijing was punishing Seoul for its decision to install the THAAD missile defense system, which was aimed at North Korea, but they perceived was being aimed at them. And it decided recently to lift its export ban and allow Chinese tour visits to South Korea. How does that rapprochement between Beijing and Seoul affect U.S.-South Korean ties?
Well, that's just the sort of event I'm talking about that could serve to change U.S.-Korea relations, or at least relations between Trump and Moon Jae-in. We were on the same page with regard to China for the last 9 months or so, or at least since Moon came in later in the year. So now that the South Koreans are patching it up with the Chinese, I think that could expose some of the underlying differences between the two.
How do you see that, Patrick Cronin, this rapprochement affecting U.S.-South Korean relations?
Well, I think China wants to elicit more positive relations with Seoul because the pressure strategy against them, the economic coercion they've used against South Korea because they've deployed a missile defense battery, hasn't really worked. So China's pivoting in the other direction here, and South Korea's saying, yeah, let's go along with these basic principles you've outlined, even though we haven't agreed to anything. But these are the so-called three no's that China asked for. No additional THAAD missile defense batteries to be deployed. No formal alliance between and among Japan, ROK, and the United States. And no further integration of their missile defense systems. None of that was in the cards in the short term anyhow. So South Korea has not given anything away and hasn't signed anything. But China's now set the new principles by which they'll judge whether they should be more or less cooperative with South Korea.
Walter, the White House said that President Trump would decide by next week whether or not to redesignate North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. That was a status it held until the George W. Bush administration dropped it from the list in 2008. Do you think that North Korea should be redesignated as a state sponsor of terrorism at this point? How effective would that be?
I do think they need to be redesignated. They're obviously guilty of terrorism, if only for the assassination attempt on Kim Jong-un's half-brother in Malaysia. Well, it was more than an attempt. It was successful in their effort actually within China to target his son. So they're definitely engaged in terrorism. How effective it would be? Largely the sanctions that would come in place are duplicative of the ones that are already in place. But it's still a blow to them, and it's an encouragement to all of the countries around the world now we're approaching to cut relations with North Korea.
How do you see that, Patrick Cronin? Is that a good idea? Would our allies be encouraged by that, or could that harm the ultimate objective of thwarting North Korea's nuclear ambitions?
I don't think it could do any harm. I think the bigger request right now from the Trump administration is for the full enforcement of sanctions economically, to really pressure North Korea economically, because they're hoping that with China's help, that over the next 6 to 9 months, the revenues coming into North Korea are significantly, more than a third, cut, so that North Korea has some greater incentive to stop the nuclear testing, stop the long-range missile testing, and come back to the table. I think that economic sanctions are going to have a lot better chance of working than just calling them out for being a terrorist nation, although the president did say pretty bluntly in the National Assembly speech that this is a cult. This is indeed an extreme regime.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Walter Lohmann, director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Patrick Cronin, from whom you just heard. He's senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We're discussing and assessing President Donald Trump's trip across Asia. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Payam. He's a loyal listener from Perth, Australia. Well, back to you, Walter Lohmann. Let's talk about President Trump's visit to China, the Beijing leg. Of course, President Xi coming off of the recent Communist Party Congress, re-cementing his role as a party leader, as a very strong leader. He sees the United States and China as co-superpowers. How would you assess President Trump's visit, his sort of increasing cozying up to Xi, trying to persuade him to exert more pressure on North Korea to curtail its nuclear ambitions?
Well, as I say, I think we'll have to wait a little bit of time to see how successful it actually is in terms of action from the Chinese on North Korea. I think most China experts will tell you that this approach to Xi Jinping to sort of flatter him into agreement with you is not going to work. The administration is going to have to bring real pressure to bear if it's going to have any impact on Chinese calculations about its allies in North Korea. So we'll see what he said behind the scenes. Hopefully he threatened some of these actions and that this public expression of admiration for Xi Jinping did not continue behind closed doors.
Patrick Cronin, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that there's no space between both of our objectives, i.e. Beijing and Washington. But he said we have our own view of the tactics and the timing and how far to go with pressure with respect to North Korea. Do you think the United States is overestimating Xi's leverage over Kim Jong-un? You know, the United States is asking for China to close North Korea bank accounts, cut off coal purchases, send North Korean workers home, to cut off oil shipment. Are any of these demands going to be met by China? What did we get from China vis-a-vis North Korea?
North Korea was the bigger of the two asks from President Trump of Communist Party Chairman Xi Jinping. And I think the United States has won a commitment to do some more actions to pressure North Korea, but not nearly as many as we'd like. And this whole policy is an exploration in how far China might go to join a maximum pressure strategy. Any gains that we get from China cooperating on this, we think will be useful. How much leverage does China have? Theoretically, it has a lot because of the economic flows from China to North Korea. Practically speaking, China's never going to give us as much as we want. But again, as I say, if we can even cut the revenue coming into North Korea over the next 6 to 9 months, one-third, they could really feel enough pressure to at least want to consider some diplomacy. It may not work, but nothing else has worked either. So, you know, using the maximum pressure strategy is at least a sensible approach when you don't want to cause war, but you definitely want to deter North Korea from ever using these weapons or even trying to acquire them.
So, Walter, do you think President Trump was able to convince Xi Jinping to implement these more forceful sanctions, any of these actions? Or is China more concerned about, you know, North Korea being a valuable buffer against reunification of the Korean Peninsula, of refugees flowing over the border? I mean, how does he, that is Xi Jinping, see the balance of power and interests?
Well, several of the things you mentioned, the coal shipments, natural gas and oil, and many other things are already mandated by the UN Security Council and resolutions that the Chinese voted for. So they should be willing to implement those. And that's been part of the problem over the years, is that not only do they drag out these negotiations over each successive Security Council resolution, really as an advocate for North Korea, but then they don't implement them fully. So hopefully, Donald Trump could at least convince the Chinese to implement the things that they have agreed to implement as a part of the UN Security Council.
And of course, Patrick Cronin, there are other topics. There are the maritime disputes in the South China Sea. What, if anything, did the United States get with regard to China's aggressive actions in the South China Sea?
Well, the other big ask of President Trump in facing President Xi in Beijing was actually on the trade issue, market access and the trade imbalance. The issue of the South China Sea came up in passing, but it really was part of the speech in Da Nang, Vietnam, where the president spoke eloquently about a free and open Indo-Pacific region. And he did mention, as he had in Beijing, that the United States is not going to change its commitment to freedom of navigation. This is a long-standing practice of how America has engaged across Asia in the Indo-Pacific region for more than a couple hundred years. So nothing was really sought. Rather, the position was stated.
How do you see that, Walter Lohmann, notwithstanding the South China Sea maritime disputes, not perhaps as prominent topic as the market access and trade imbalance? Do you see any movement in that regard in our differences over the South China Sea?
No, and I think that's a positive thing out of this trip. As transactional as Trump seems to be, there didn't seem to be any trade-offs between important American interests. For example, we didn't trade off freedom of the seas in the South China Sea for increased market access or something like that. On the issue of market access in particular, I don't know how much more we're going to get on that. We've renegotiated with the Chinese on several things that they've already agreed to. For instance, in May, we got a new commitment on them importing beef, something they had already promised to do, but now they promised to do again. So each time they offer these same issues up, what the president did do is focus on a lot of business deals. And so by reports, got $250 billion worth of business deals. We don't know exactly what they are, what they represent. Are they MOUs at this point? Do they wrap in several different projects that were already in process or not? But that seems to be where he's focused. He has an obsession with a trade deficit, not the best measure of the health of our trading relationships, but that's what he cares most about. But he's not going to get at that by one-off deals with Boeing and GE and others. He's going to have to address bigger systemic issues, both in the American economy and in the Chinese economy and in the way that they interact.
Well, back to you, Patrick Cronin, with regard to the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, which began on Friday in Da Nang, Vietnam. How do you see the outcome of that particular forum and what's in it for the United States? Mr. Trump was supposed to be pushing, you know, bilateral free trade agreements. What was the takeaway from that particular forum?
Well, going into the APEC summit meeting of leaders, President Trump was able to give an outline of his administration's Asia policy. This is this free and open Indo-Pacific. I think the elements of continuity in a Trump administration's approach to trade and investment are seen as positive. And from countries like Vietnam that still want to be doing more trade and investment with the United States, it was one of the, and it is one of the stakeholders in the TPP, there's a great opportunity for even that bilateral relationship. I think there's still questions about America's economic weight, though, especially since President Trump's main strategic objective in Asia is to be able to compete in the long run with this rising China. And outside of TPP, where we had a chance of having some geopolitical sway in the region, not just economic ties, we haven't fully joined that debate about how we get there. And I think that's not resolved, but we'll see. At least this outline that he's given in Vietnam of a free and open Indo-Pacific can be built on. And watch that space. Let's see what else we can do.
Well, that's interesting. You know, watch that space. How can he build on that free and open Indo-Pacific area? But how does he do that, Walter Lohmann, without a powerful tool such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership? And we also heard that Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was supposed to be having some conversations about trying to keep the Trans-Pacific Partnership alive, even without the United States, because countries in the region see value in that as a way to counter the rise of China.
Well, that really is the question. How does he create this free and open Indo-Pacific without a positive trade agenda? The trade agenda is largely focused on trade remedies and deficits and renegotiating trade agreements and that sort of thing. And because it's so focused that way, it's hard to actually engage people. I agree that in Japan, the two sides agreed basically on not disagreeing, but they also didn't agree. So the problem is the one positive element that Trump is bringing to the table is that he wants to negotiate a bilateral free trade agreement with Japan. Japan doesn't really want any part of it. One, because they're seeing that U.S. trade policy is largely negative. Why would the Japanese sign up to what's going on in our NAFTA negotiations, sort of maximalist demands and threats to withdraw and all the rest? So if President Trump wants to have a positive element here, he's going to have to reformulate his entire trade policy. He's going to have to give it a positive spin. The other reason that the Japanese don't want much to do with a bilateral agreement is because they made so many concessions in the TPP, concessions that they have a hard time duplicating in some sort of bilateral agreement, especially because they suspect, I think correctly, that Trump administration would ask for even more concessions. So they've pursued this TPP-11, which puts them really at the center of the members of the TPP minus the United States, with the prospect one day of the United States coming back in. And they've sealed that deal at APEC. They've actually agreed to move forward and come up with a framework for concluding.
Well, that's really fascinating. Well, as we conclude, Patrick Cronin, just basically your assessment, final takeaway from this trip, which is still ongoing. What specific progress do you think was made toward denuclearizing North Korea, one of the main objectives, and on trade? And where did Mr. Trump perhaps fall short?
Denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is the long-term vision, but nobody thinks it has any prospect in the short term. So really the goal there is to maximize pressure on North Korea to see if we can get to some kind of freeze for something, some kind of pause that provides diplomatic space to deal with this issue. In the meantime, we avoid war. On the economic issue, at least the president has shown his commitment to economic growth. He wants to make sure that the region sees the United States as an economic player in the long term. If he can achieve that, he has a path back to TPP. He has a path back to having some geoeconomic and geopolitical leadership in the region, even though right now the game is China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is kind of influencing the region.
RCEP
as well. RCEP is sort of the low standard free trade agreement, but the Belt and Road Initiative is really the rubric under which Xi Jinping of China is talking about major infrastructure development, both maritime and on land across Eurasia and the Pacific.
And the last word to you, Walter Lohmann, on your final takeaway from this important trip, specific progress you think was made toward denuclearizing North Korea, and of course on the trade, which I know you have some issues with.
The most important thing here about this trip is it is a commitment by the President of the United States to traditional U.S. positions in the Western Pacific. That's the most important thing that comes away from this, and he has done it. Now, you could go back 6 months ago, and we couldn't take that for granted. Okay, so he's done the right thing there. On the trade side, I don't see U.S. role economically in the region as competing with China, and I don't see it as economic growth. I see it as a matter of encouraging economic freedom. And the only way that you do that, really, practically speaking, is through free trade agreements. And if the president wants to get back to some kind of free trade agreements, he's going to have a positive element to his trade policy and not just renegotiations and remedies and protectionism. He's going to have to think about this in a new way.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Walter Lohmann, Director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Patrick Cronin, Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was John Ellison. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.